physical sciences spectrum here. It's very good to have Chris Mulhern with us, and he got his his first degree in mechanical engineering. He's gone on to philosophy. He's been a missionary in Argentina for 30 years. So he's been
13.
I misunderstood you. I'm sorry. Well, it's still a significant period of time. He's now in philosophy, but he's from Australia, and I'm pleased to say he is, what is it, 3/5 time as head of ISCAST, the Christians and Science version in Australia. And so he's here to kind of the kinship with our organizations. And so I'm very pleased to have Chris here to talk about balls, strikes, and truth in a postmodern world.
Thanks, Randy. As you can see, I thought that the two talks today were going to be very different, but there is a distinct connection to what we've heard in the discussion about relativism and has modern physics shown that we don't know anything, things like that, to what I'm going to talk about, although what I am going to talk about is, I guess, slightly more philosophical. Also, the things that I want to say today will only happen if I read my paper. If I don't read my paper, we'll be here all afternoon, except that I have a bus to catch at 11:30, so you can relax about that one too. And before I do start, I want to say thank you. I've come from Australia to meet with people from the ASA, to meet with Leslie and other people. It's been great to be here. I'm very grateful for the welcome I've had. That, you know, it's friendly people all over the place. Some of you I've met and talked to. So from afar, thank you for having me. It's been great to be here. So I went to the Boston Red Sox on whatever night it was, Thursday night, in my jet-lagged state. And just imagine, I won't try and pass this off as a true story, and it's probably a story that you know fairly well, the story of the three baseball umpires arguing about reality. And so the first one says, you know, they're in the pub, they've had a few drinks, the pub, do you call it a pub here? Whatever it is. Whatever we did the other night when it was called, what was it called, Kirk?
Choir practice.
Am I allowed to mention choir practice in this company? Choir practice it was. So after choir practice, the three umpires are having a bit of a conversation. The first one says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. The second one says, no way, that's not how it is. That's a sort of arrogant attitude. There's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. And the third one says, no, that's no better. Why beat around the bush? Why not be realistic about what we do? There's balls and there's strikes, and they ain't nothing till I call them. Now, I won't go into all the details of how you might interpret that, but by the end of my talk, I will have interpreted that slightly differently than the way it's normally used in circles where we talk about relativism. But as I said, if I don't read, we'll never get anywhere, so let me read. With that introduction, let me respond to the sort of problem epitomised by those umpires. My paper today concerns how human beings arrive at knowledge claims, and I would like to introduce you to Huffpat. No, Huffpat is not a little furry Aussie critter. Huffpat is a hermeneutic, universal, fiduciary and provisional approach to truth. And my claim is that Huffpat is an accurate description of how we arrive at knowledge in areas as diverse as theology, history, the appreciation of art, and the natural sciences. In short, that all knowledge is hermeneutic in a sense that I hope to clarify. Huffpat affirms a robust understanding of truth, while at the same time recognising the validity of criticisms of overly ambitious epistemologies or theories of knowledge. And it explains how the areas of knowledge that I've just mentioned might offer legitimate and similarly founded truth claims which avoid falling into the extremes of either a naive optimism based on method and the disengaged objective human subject, or into a relativism that cannot make universal truth claims. For simplicity, I would call those two extremes postmodern relativism and fundamentalist dogmatism, the latter of which can, of course, come in religious and atheist varieties. Huffpat arises in response to what Charles Taylor calls the struggle over the corpse of epistemology. With Taylor, I agree that the struggle is a significant one. To quote Taylor, what is at stake are some of the most important spiritual issues of our time. In the light of the moribund Cartesian quest for certitude, is there a future for clarifying how we come to know? Or must the patient be allowed to rest in peace as we accustom ourselves to a new sort of cognitive landscape where truth and knowledge amount to nothing more than, to quote Richard Rorty, amount to nothing more than what one's peers will let one get away with saying? Is that the definition of truth these days? So I'm concerned for truth and justification after the fall of the Cartesian paradigm, in which justification of our knowledge claims has been assumed to be objective and governed by strictly applied methods that would guarantee truth as an outcome. This is the doomed quest of what I call traditional epistemology, which is closely allied with a positivistic received view of science. In his second meditation, almost 500 years ago, René Descartes set the stage for that ill-fated quest. He said, "Archimedes used to demand just one firm and immovable point in order to shift the entire earth. So I too can hope for great things if I manage to find just one thing, however slight, that is certain and unshakable." End of quote. But the modern epistemological quest, that is the Cartesian dream of indubitable knowledge, which has been pursued with more vengeance by his followers than by Descartes himself, this quest has failed. For Christians, theological interpretation is fundamental to dealing with Taylor's important spiritual issues of our time. But underlying the question of theological and biblical hermeneutics is the universal problem of understanding understanding. How do we arrive at our understanding of texts, of people, of traditions, of history? This is not self-evident. And how shall we justify our claims to have understood correctly? So what remains after the passing of traditional epistemology? There are two options. The first is that of pursuing a more nuanced theory of knowledge that recognises the provisionality of our epistemic pretensions, as well as the ontological condition in which we find ourselves, but which remains committed to the search for what I'm calling robust truth. Robust here, referring both to the universal ambit of knowledge claims, that is, true for all, and also to our ability to offer good reasons why these knowledge claims should be accepted. A second option in the face of the failure of post-Cartesian epistemology is to throw an epistemic tantrum. This is the postmodern mindset that resigns itself to epistemic pessimism, even incoherent relativism, believing that whatever the actual nature of the world, the human condition entails such limited access to it or confidence about it, including such massive disagreement, that claims to truth are not warranted or justified, or perhaps even not universal. Huffpat arises by following two parallel paths or conversations about understanding and human knowing. One conversation is that which concerns interpretation in the human sciences, a conversation governed by what is known as philosophical hermeneutics, and by names such as Schleiermacher, Diltai, Heidegger, Gadamer, and Ricoeur. The other conversation is about the nature of knowledge in the natural sciences, a vigorous topic in the philosophy of science of the last 60 years, and one that I've learned much about from the often unrecognised but significant contribution of scientist and would-be philosopher Michael Polanyi. And it was great to hear Polanyi mentioned this morning. And if I might make a brief comment about a talk the other day, and I can't even remember where or who was speaking, about Thomas Kuhn. Those of you who know Kuhn, you ought to know, let me just encourage you to think about this. Kuhn wrote his work, Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in 1962. Polanyi wrote his main work in 1958. Kuhn had read Polanyi. There was one footnote in Structure to Polanyi. And those who have looked at them closely and who know Polanyi well, and I'm quoting one of those scholars, say, "Everything that's good in Kuhn is found in Polanyi." Now, I'm not going to argue that point now, but it's worth thinking about. I think that what Kuhn did was he took Polanyi's best ideas and he set them out in a way that was very attractive. He used words like paradigm, revolution. Another phrase of Polanyi's is that scientists live in different worlds, and you can see that I've gone off track, so I'm going to go back to my notes. Since the demise of the polymaths of natural philosophy, these paths, natural sciences and human sciences, if you like, have diverged in the epistemic wood. And to many, it's science, the natural sciences, that's taken the path marked explanation, which is assumed to lead to sure knowledge, while other disciplines have followed the path less travelled, which leads to understanding. I contend that while these paths have been understood to be very different, in fact, the way to understanding and the way to explanation both are arrived through what I have inelegantly called a hermeneutic, universal, fiduciary and provisional approach to truth. In challenging this dichotomy between understanding and explanation, I'm elaborating on Martin Heidegger's phrase that interpretation is the basic form of all knowing. In both the natural sciences and the human sciences, access to truth follows interpretive paths. So despite Cartesian hopes of certainty, which have propelled the natural sciences to dizzying heights of authority and left other realms of thinking obscured in their shadows, all knowledge claims have similar gestations and are rooted in and never escape being provisional interpretive judgments about what is the case. While there are differences between the natural sciences and other realms of knowledge, the degree of difference is considerably lessened in the light of the mostly unexamined aspects that they share with respect to the path to understanding. The truths revealed in Macbeth and in the Large Hadron Collider arise out of following the same, often unarticulated and ultimately unarticulable hermeneutic process, which results in universal fiduciary and provisional claims to robust truth. The word hermeneutics and its cognates is often and was originally used simply as a synonym for both the first order practice of interpretation and for the second order theory of interpretive practice. I won't bother connecting my Macintosh. So hermeneutics is used for both the first order practice of interpretation and for the second order theory of interpretive practice, understood as a search for correct methods of textual interpretations. Randy, why don't you just bring me my Mac and I'll put the... Okay, however, in addition to these uses of the word hermeneutics, the so-called hermeneutic turn, initiated by Heidegger, moves hermeneutics from being understood as a method to being a description of the human condition of existence in the world. Great. Let's just do this. Except this is going to go.
You need that other piece.
Let's see if it comes on.
There you go. All right.
Let's don't tell anybody.
So for Heidegger, Heidegger moves hermeneutics from being understood as a method to being a description of the human condition of existence in the world. Or as Heidegger puts it in his hyphenated phrase that you can do in German and doesn't translate very well into English, although I'm not sure he was brilliantly understandable in German either. He uses the phrase, being in the world. One word, hyphenated, the nature of our existence. We are beings that are finite, historically and culturally conditioned, and whose very mode of being is always inherently interpretive. We are not just interpreters, we are made as interpretive beings. That is, after the turn, after this hermeneutic turn initiated by Heidegger, hermeneutics refers both to interpretation theory and practice, but also to the ontological conditions that make interpretation both possible and ubiquitous, and which dictate the nature of human understanding. In short, not only are we beings that do interpretation, but interpretation is part of our being. Another synonym for this ontologically grounded hermeneutics, which arises from the work of Heidegger and Gadamer, is philosophical hermeneutics. So, Huffpat is about what all human knowing and understanding have in common before those commonalities are lost in the differences that arise from the differing objects of knowledge claims. Differences which have convinced many people, and I really ought to go to page 7 rather than 4, which have convinced many people that some claims, for example scientific claims, are sound or at least superior and others are not so. In the differences, we've lost what all understanding holds in common, a search for truth, which, however understood, is about how things are with the one real, more than subjective world, and which is pointed to by provisional human interpretative claims made as committed judgments upon the best available evidence. But this commitment to robust truth and knowledge in whatever field should not be confused with a commitment to a generalised impersonal certainty or objectivity based on incontrovertible reasons for belief. It is in some senses an act of faith that finds its expression in provisional human judgments, judgments revealed in any individual scientist's or interpreter's committed decision to say, yes, I believe that such and such is the case. This commonality is captured in this particular understanding that describes all knowing as hermeneutic. So I turn now to reiterate and say a little bit more about the four predicates of Huffpat, starting with hermeneutic. The claim of hermeneutics to be ubiquitous is, of course, a self-referential one. There is no escaping it. In claiming that all knowledge is based on interpretation, which arises out of both ontological and epistemological hermeneutic circles, and leads to truth claims to be affirmed or denied by provisional human judgments, hermeneutics also makes a meta-claim that is itself provisional. It can't itself be proven and may be disputed. So this hermeneutic claim can only be outlined, explained, conversed about, brought into the open, and finally rejected or accepted. And isn't that just roughly what the peer literature does in, for example, the natural sciences? Ultimately rejected or accepted by error-prone humans as the truth about the way human understanding works. There's no more to be said to the skeptic about whether this hermeneutic claim is true, except perhaps if you ask for more, you demand what you cannot offer yourself for any theory of truth or knowledge. To say that all human life and practice is hermeneutic is to make an ontological claim, a claim about the very nature of our being and being itself. And it has epistemological implications for our theory of knowledge. Not only can our thought processes be described as interpretive, but the very nature of human beings is rooted in their meaning-making co-constitution with their world, of which they are inescapably a part. This is one aspect of the universality of hermeneutics. Human beings are by nature interpreting beings. Interpretation is indeed not something that we just do 24/7, although it is. It's a 24/7 activity that makes us who we are. We are meaning-making beings. And yet even in that description, a conceptual wedge is driven between the world and beings, ourselves, which according to this view, we do not exist as ourselves apart from the world in which we find our place. Therefore, hermeneutics, as I'm using it here, refers not only to an epistemological claim about the means of coming to knowledge, but also to the foundational conditions for the possibility of knowledge, including those arising from the nature of human beings who are ontologically constituted as understanding beings. Let me move on to universality and explain a bit more about what I mean by that. There are three senses in which Huffpat points to the universal nature of hermeneutics. They are what I will call the epistemic, the epistemological, and the ontological senses. The first one, the epistemic sense, points to the universality of truth, while the other two senses arise from the universality alluded to just now, inherent in the conditions for the possibility of knowledge. The first one, the epistemic feature of Huffpat's universality, is that our claims are about universal truth, this sense of universality is set in contrast to what we might loosely call relativism or better relativisms. Robust truth, as I'm calling it, is universal, true for all, we might say, or true irrespective of what an individual or group or culture thinks about the matter. Or again, with caveats in place, universal truth might be described by some as a synonym for absolute truth, although the term absolute introduces unhelpful connotations of a sort of imaginary unworlded knower, which would be inconsistent with the provisionality of Huffpat that arises from universal ontological conditions and not merely the epistemological difficulties of knowing. So in a description borrowed from Michael Polanyi, despite the subjective element inherent on all truth claims, they are made with universal intent. They point to the reality beyond the knower. Note that while I describe Huffpat as an accurate account of human knowing practices that can validly make robust truth claims, that should not be understood as a contention about a human ability to ascertain what is true and to offer undeniable reasons for its claims. So Polanyi's universal intent describes the scope but not the strength of the claim. While something is claimed to be universally true, the claim is necessarily a provisional one. In other words, such claims are about how things are, independent of my thinking about how things are, and their truth is independent of the knower who asserts that such claims are true. So, for example, while snow is white is a proposition embedded in language and concepts, it nevertheless makes a truth claim about something that is extra-linguistic and extra-conceptual. Whether we talk of Newton and Einstein or Romeo and Juliet, some interpretations are simply better than others. They're not purely relative or random. But conviction, not certainty or incontrovertibility, is the appropriate description of beliefs that cannot claim certainty. The second sense of universality is the epistemological sense. To assent to the broad picture that philosophical hermeneutics paints is to accept that knowing is not a linear process. For example, and most commonly, a procedure that starts with some sort of foundations and then shoring up each step in a chain of reasoning arrives at a knowledge claim. Rather, knowing is an iterative art of discerning meaningful connections, a process where there is interdependence between the parts and the whole of a meaningful structure. This ubiquitous circle of understanding has been recognised in the area of textual interpretation, particularly biblical interpretation, at least as far back as Baruch Spinoza, and formalised in the early 19th century by Schleiermacher, who said, quote, "Complete knowledge always involves an apparent circle. Each part can be understood only out of the whole to which it belongs, and vice versa. All knowledge must be constructed in this way." Hans-Georg Gadamer puts it like this, quote, "Our task is to expand the unity of the understood meaning centrifugally. The harmony of all the details with the whole is the criterion of correct understanding. The failure to achieve this harmony means that understanding has failed." End of quote. And it's Gadamer more than anyone who's responsible for showing that if all truth arises by means of a hermeneutic circle or spiral, then hermeneutics is a description of human understanding and cognitive engagement that is universal, rather than being limited to a field or aspect of life, such as textual interpretation or the humanities or quotidian life in its untheorized normality. For this reason, the universality of Huffpat extends even to the natural sciences, traditionally seen as distinctive in their objectivity and disengaged explanation of the natural world as it really is. The third sense of universal is the ontological. I've already mentioned that a bit. Philosophical hermeneutics reveals the universality of our being in the world, to speak Heideggerian. In claiming universality at the ontological level, Huffpat goes beyond a mere description of the methods or maxims of understanding. It makes claims about what it means to be human and asserts that intrinsic to being human is that we are beings for whom understanding, in Heidegger's very particular existential or ontological sense, is part of our essence. Let me turn to fiduciary, and I will finish in a page. 5 minutes, no trouble. The fiduciary aspect of HuffPat, which arises partly from the provisionality that I'm going to turn to in a moment, is an entailment of the apparently banal but important recognition that all-knowing, when stated explicitly, results in human truth claims or beliefs for which I am to some degree accountable. There is no sincere statement of claimed knowledge that cannot be prefaced with, "It is my belief that." And in that statement also hides the tacit assertion that I am responsibly committed to the belief that. This is one aspect of what Polanyi points to in arguing for the fiduciary basis of all knowledge. Knowledge claims involve trusting and trustworthy commitment that often remains unexpressed, but which is inherent in the logic of making a claim. This aspect of knowledge claims, of explicitly pointing to the personal responsibility involved in making any claim or in accepting a claim by another, is the universal fiduciary element of HuffPat. There are no knowledge claims that are not personal claims, and those claims are held with varying degrees of conviction and varying degrees of reflexivity by those who claim to know. Strictly speaking, if objectivity is understood to exclude subjectivity, there are no objective claims and there is no objective knowledge. Only subjects, only knowers, can know and can state claims. And so the first-person language of conviction, of belief, of responsible judgment is more transparent than a language that obscures the fiduciary aspects of any knowledge claim by depersonalising it. Finally, to the last of the four predicates of HuffPat, to describe a claim as provisional explicitly recognises that despite its being made with universal intent, there is no guarantee either that agreement will be reached or that I or we are right. Being aware of the conditioning of history, culture, language, and of reason itself, as well as the inability to offer anything that resembles rigorous proof, means I concede that my knowledge claims are provisional. They may be wrong. And the example I often give is that of climate change. Climate scientists are convinced that they are right, and yet if you go up to any climate scientist and say, well, just prove it and I'll believe you, they will say, that's not how science works. I can't prove it to you. I'm convinced. The experts in the field are convinced. We ought to do something about it. We are talking about a reality that is out there, but ask me to prove it in that sense, that's just not quite how science works. As I've already mentioned, the Cartesian dream of finding a high road to sure knowledge has only run into dead ends, made evident at both the epistemic and ontological levels. Epistemically, there are no indubitable foundations upon which to build deductive edifices. This much is by now almost incontrovertible. But more fundamentally, the Cartesian dream that depends on the objective, disengaged human subject, standing in some sense apart from the object known, is, according to a hermeneutic understanding, based on a false and confused ontology. While the epistemic difficulties of the modern Cartesian quest have significantly contributed to what some have called postmodernism, and a resultant epistemic indolence that equates provisionality with relativism or agnosticism, a hermeneutic ontology reveals that there should be a circumspection involved in making what are provisional assertions. 1 minute. This caution is rooted in the recognition of a finitude more profound than can be overcome by simply honing our methods and increasing the number of significant figures of our claims. And I'm going to skip on to my conclusion. So I'm suggesting that a hermeneutic, universal, fiduciary and provisional approach to truth is the unavoidable condition and also the common practice of our knowledge claims ranging across all areas of practical and intellectual endeavour. All knowing is hermeneutic for the reasons that I've outlined. And this idea incorporates a robust understanding of truth, at the same time recognising the validity of criticisms of overly ambitious epistemologies. And I'm going to stop there. Thanks, Randy.
two quick questions before he goes to the bus. Let's see. You answer one for. How about Chris?
Thank you for that. I like Pat. I think Australian zoologists have missed a golden opportunity to meet some fuzzy creature. So I'm sitting here looking at your four qualities there as a postmodernist. Some like provisional, synthetic hermeneutic, obviously.
That's telling me my bus is going. So that's okay. Carry on, Chris.
The others, but particularly the universal. So this could be either descriptive or prescriptive, but on the prescriptive side, why should I be convinced by my theory of the postmodern out there in the university classroom?
Why should you be convinced? Ultimately, you should be convinced because as we converse, it's a different language. You know, this is much more continental philosophy than analytic philosophy. As we converse about whether this is actually how it is. It's slightly phenomenological as well. So Polanyi, not a phenomenologist, but Polanyi, the experienced scientist, looking at what he does in science, realizes that what he does in science is not correctly described by the received view of the scientific method or something. And that's how he works up in 1958 personal knowledge, his understanding of science. So we are convinced because as we look at it, is this a description of what's going on? Now, there's a lot more questions to be answered, which I would love to have another lifetime to answer. But to first base, Is this a more coherent description of what's going on than the theorised views of, well, the scientific method is like this, and if you just do this and this and this? So I guess you get convinced by the conversation, which is a very sort of hermeneutic Gadamerian thing to do.
One more question over there.
I was wondering, you talked a lot about that hermeneutical, its interpretive approach, and it's interesting within the context of a self-referencing system, because we're in the world, as you said.
Yep.
I'm curious if you have any thoughts as to our ability to be both in the world and not of the world, giving us that opportunity to actually make accurate judgments, because thus we're somewhat in a self-referencing system, but somewhat not.
Can you repeat the question here? So we're in the world. That's part of the description. How can we get out of the world to a sense to make... And the answer ultimately is no. Ultimately, we can never get out of the world in which we find ourselves. Ultimately, we are on, I think it's Carnap's boat. We are on the boat at sea. But the boat is real. We would like to be able to step off the boat and have a God's eye view and be totally outside the world and be able to look down and say, well, the world is like this, disconnected from me. And that's the Cartesian, that's what Cartesianism has given us, this subject-object separation. But ultimately, we can never separate ourselves from the world. You take away all the world from me and you've got nothing left. Once you take away my past connections with the world, my future possibilities with the world, you have nothing left, because I am who I am as a being making a meaning, making being in the world.
Yeah. Okay. So my question was more, because we have the image of God in us, and Jesus says, be in but not of the world,
yep.
we are part of the system, but at the same time, we're somewhat removed by our very nature as being bearers of the image of God. Do you think that would happen?
Without thinking about it further and knowing the time, my first intuition is that's making a slide between an ethical call about not being in the world to an epistemological and ontological condition. Epistemologically and ontologically, we are inevitably part of the world. Ethically, Christians are called to separate from the world to some extent while still being in the world. So I think we're dealing with different realms. That's my first thought. But it's an interesting thought to take up and see if you can apply that ethical idea to the epistemological thoughts.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And you still have time to catch your bus.